Good morning, everybody. Good afternoon. Yes, I never get used to that. It's a quarter after 12. Welcome to Dr. Hugh Ross's Paradox class. I want to start out by thanking Dan Cuevas, who isn't even here, but he called me this morning and he said, "You guys having class?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Good, I'm sending over pizza." So it's pretty dedicated for somebody to provide treats and they're not even here. So next time you see Dan, say thanks for the pizza. And thank you to everybody else that puts that table together and brings food and makes coffee and makes Paradox one of the most amazing classes here at Christ Church. Thank you for everybody that shows up. Hugh's schedule, we have the great privilege of having Hugh Ross with us every week for several weeks, I think 10 or 12 or something like that, with the exception of, okay, for all you people who ignore the announcements and aren't really listening to me, write this down. Can I get your attention? Okay, there is class next week, the 22nd. There is no Paradox class on the 29th, so the Sunday between Christmas and New Year's. We are dark. There is no Sunday school. There is no Paradox class December 29th. Everybody get this. You all got that at home. All of you online. Class next week. No class the week after. Okay, good. We need to say a prayer for Mark and Val Durham, who are usually right there, who help me and a lot of other people run this class. They are both sick with some kind of respiratory ailment, so please say a prayer for them, and that next week they can be back. They're going to be okay, but they're going through something called RSV, Hugh, or do you know what that is? Maybe when you come up you can tell us about it. You had your shot, okay. Yeah, good. For those of you who are sort of new to the class, I want to remind you that this class is really just the tip of the iceberg with what Hugh Ross does, and also this class. This class is, you've heard us say it, this class has been going on for about 50 years. If you go to Paradoxes, plural, paradoxes.org, you can get archived recordings of this class that go back many, many years. We used to keep them on cassette tape. That's how long this class has been around. I don't know how far back it goes online, but I think it's at least 10 years. And then Hugh Ross, who you may only know from this class, is the founder of Reasons to Believe, and Reasons to Believe has a gigantic presence in the apologetic community. So if you're only familiar with Hugh, go to reasons.org. Again, plural, reasons.org, and you'll find all of the universe of the stuff that they do. They have a really great presence on YouTube as well. So if you like to watch stuff on YouTube, look up Reasons to Believe. I want to say thank you to the people in the booth back there. Tim, who was here like at sunup, putting stuff together. And Jamie and Maria, who I'm sure were here for at least an hour, is that right? Okay. Thanks to everybody who helps put the class together. So let's say a prayer and we'll get to Hugh Ross. Heavenly Father, thank you. We never want to stop being grateful. I don't ever want to take things for granted, Lord, that you provide for us. We thank you for Dr. Ross and what he's meant to everyone who's had contact with him and this class for all the time that he's had his ministry. Thank you for everybody that's here that listens and is receptive in humility to your word, both in our heart and in our head. Thank you for this country where we are still safe and peaceful and have liberty to be able to worship you and honor you. Thank you for all of these people that are my friend. And thank you, Lord, for the beautiful day, beautiful California winter day outside. Ask your blessing on Dr. Ross as he teaches us this morning, and on each one of us as we go our way this afternoon. Thank you so much. In Jesus' name, amen. Please Welcome, Dr. Hugh Ross.
Well, thank you, and Merry Christmas to all of you. And we're doing a series on Noah's flood, but I'm going to take a little bit of a break, at least for the first part of today, to talk to you about a special Christmas gift that astronomers received literally just days ago. And it's three research papers that are being published in the Journal of Cosmology and Astroparticle Physics. If you're not familiar with that journal, just go online. You'll love reading all, at least the abstracts. And those of you who like tensor calculus, I'm sure you'll enjoy reading the entire papers. But this is a coalition of hundreds of astronomers who have basically been using an instrument not too far away from here. It's in Arizona on the mountain called Kitt Peak. And on that mountain, they have a 4-meter telescope. It's called the Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument. And it's a dedicated instrument. Basically, the whole time of the telescope is devoted to measuring the distances and the positions of distant galaxies and quasars. It's a 5-year project, and just a few days ago, they released the first year's worth of their results. So this is what the telescope looks like. And this is the inside of the telescope dome. This particular map actually shows you the telescope, the dome, and then you see the angle there. Those are the galaxies that's been observed. So they haven't yet done a full sky survey. Even when they're done with the 5 years, it will not be a full sky survey. But the first year as a result basically shows us kind of an angular swath of all the galaxies and galaxy clusters out to a certain distance. And they have measured, pardon me, let me see if I can find that. Yes. Okay. They have measured the redshifts, and redshift is a way of determining a distance and the positions of 3,855,000 galaxies and 857,000 quasars. No survey has ever looked at that many galaxies and quasars before. And they've measured them in a redshift range from 0.1 to 2.1. And now you can go online to what's called Ned Wright's Cosmology Calculator, and it'll convert that redshift for you into actual distances from the Earth. I've already done that for you. These are galaxies and quasars that are between 1.3 and 10.6 billion light years away from the Earth. So first year's been released, 4 more years are coming, but already what they see in the first release is really quite astounding, and even could lead to the winning of a Nobel Prize. And the telescope is basically dedicated, and this team of astronomers are trying to determine a more accurate measurement of the matter of the universe and really trying to determine what dark energy is all about. I mean, the dark energy spectroscopic instrument is designed to uncover what is exactly behind dark energy. Now, the significance of this in terms of creation is that people who doubt what the Bible says about the creation of the universe are saying, wait a minute, we don't understand dark energy. We really haven't found the stuff that's behind the dark matter. Maybe the biblically predicted Big Bang creation model isn't all that it's cracked up to be. Well, these three papers basically, I think, are going to put that to rest, at least to some degree. And by the way, more observations are coming. And it is true, we don't know the particles that are behind dark matter, but for very good reason. There are two kinds of matter: matter that's ordinary and matter that's dark. Matter that's ordinary is matter that interacts with light. And so that would include electrons, protons, neutrons. It's the stuff we're all made up of. It's the stuff we're all used to. We call it ordinary matter because we're very familiar with it. But ordinary matter is a property that it strongly interacts with photons. Dark matter has a property that it very weakly interacts with photons, And there's some astrophysicists who think there could be a big chunk of dark matter that doesn't interact at all. Well, in order for us astronomers to actually see these dark matter particles, we have to see the light. And if it's an extremely weak interaction, that light is going to be very, very difficult to detect. So a lot of people have been skeptical of the Big Bang creation model because they say you haven't even found the dark matter particles yet. Well, the truth is we found a few of them, but they don't make up most of the mass of the universe. But the whole point is, the fact that we haven't found them is actually exactly what we predict. This stuff is dark. It does not interact very well with light. And therefore, the fact that we're having difficulty detecting it is exactly what we would expect. If it indeed is an extremely weak interaction, even our most powerful telescopes are going to be challenged to detect these particles. On the other hand, instruments like the Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument are very good at detecting the gravitational influence of all these dark matter particles. And what was published just days ago, and yet is, by the way, just to reassure you, it hasn't gone completely through the peer review process. What I'm reporting to you are the preprints. They get released first, so you're getting this news on the ground floor. But the journal is the Journal of Cosmology and Astroparticle Physics. Basically, it's saying we're reviewing it now, and the fact that the authors have said, hey, it's submitted, they're reviewing it, means the probability that it's going to pass the peer review process is above 99.9%. And incidentally, there are hundreds of astronomers on the paper, and so they make sure as they begin to check the writing of the paper that what's in there is quite secure. But the first thing I want to share with you is that because of the measurements of these 4.7 million galaxies and quasars, we now have the best measurement of the total quantity of matter in the universe. And it's accurate to better than 0.5%. So this is the value, that the mass of the universe adds up to 30.56% of everything that exists in the universe. And the error bar you can see there is only about 0.0049, 0.5%. It ranks as the most accurate measurement of the total mass of the universe. Now, we don't need to actually detect the particles to measure the total mass. We get the total mass simply by measuring the gravitational influence that matter has on the dynamics of the universe. I mean, to put it in this context, is that if you got massive bodies, they have the property that they attract one another. And the closer they are together, the more powerfully they attract. And so as we look far away in the universe, we notice in the expanding universe, the galaxies far away are closer together, which means we're going to see a stronger gravitational interaction than galaxies that we see today that are relatively far apart. And so by measuring galaxies at all these different distances, literally over a swath of 10 billion light years, they're able to detect the effect of the total mass of the universe. So that's how the measurement was achieved, but it does rank as the most accurate measurement to date. And they got a little extra accuracy by combining the dynamics of all these galaxies with the measurements of the radiation left over from the cosmic creation event, what's called the cosmic microwave background radiation. And the other thing they're able to do is to put a limit on the total mass of neutrinos. Neutrinos are the only dark matter particles that we've been able to detect. And all three have been detected. There are three different kinds of neutrinos: the electron neutrino, the muon neutrino, and the tau neutrino. And when I was an undergraduate student, I was taught by my professors, yes, these neutrinos exist, but they have no mass. We now know that they definitely do have a mass. But we've not actually been able to measure with any precision the mass of these particles. We know that they have at least about 0.05 electron volts. And so we know a lower limit. And what the people here at the Dark Energy spectroscopic instrument have been able to do is determine a good upper limit. And so we have a lower limit and we have an upper limit, so we know the mass of these neutrinos in between. Now, we can't measure the mass of the individual neutrinos. So all we can do is determine the mass of the sum of the electron neutrino, the muon neutrino, and the tau neutrino. And so this is by far the best upper limit achieved to date on the sum of the masses of these three different kinds of neutrinos. And, these theoretical physicists, I don't know where they come up with these terms, but they refer to these three different kinds of neutrinos as flavors. And so you've got an electron flavor, a muon flavor, and a tau flavor. And I was at one conference once where they were serving ice cream, and they said, this is the tau flavor, the muon flavor, and this is the electron flavor. So, but it really has nothing to do with taste. So, but as you can see here, we now have an upper limit that's quite close to the lower limit. So we're getting a handle on the masses of these neutrinos. And as I mentioned, these are the only dark matter particles that we have been able to detect. And the previous best was about 1.4. So what we have here is a measurement where the upper limit is now a factor or two better than we had a year ago. And what you'll see if you go on Wikipedia is that the limit we had was 0.8, which means this is more than 10 times better. But Wikipedia needs to be updated because we now have a measurement from 2 years ago of 1.4 times 10 to the minus 7 of the electron mass. So, that's 50%. It's not quite a factor two. It's about 60% lower than the best measurement we had before. Now, what this tells us is that neutrinos can only make up a very, very tiny percentage of the total amount of dark matter in the universe. There are lots of neutrinos, and you say, how many neutrinos? Well, kind of look at your thumbnail. Your thumbnail, a trillion neutrinos goes through your thumbnail literally every second. And you say, gee, I haven't noticed that. Well, the reason why you haven't noticed that, those neutrinos do not interact with photons except at an extremely very, very weak level. And so trillions of neutrinos, quadrillions of neutrinos are literally going through your body every hour. And you say, hey, what happens when one of them interacts with a photon in my body? Not much at all. Probably has happened once or twice in your lifetime. Doesn't really do much. But typically what happens, the neutrinos go right through you and don't interact with anything and don't disturb anything. But there's lots of them. But given this extremely low mass, as you can see, about 1/10 millionth the mass of an electron, that if you add up all those neutrinos, it doesn't add up to that much. So what it tells us is other particles must be making up the majority of the dark matter in the universe. But we do now have an accurate measurement of how much of this dark matter is there. And you say, well, how much of it is ordinary? The ordinary matter makes up 4.4%. And so the total is 30.56%, which means the dark matter is 30.56 minus 4.4, which is about 26.6, which means there's about six times more dark matter than there is ordinary matter. So, you know, we think ordinary matter is all there is, but dark stuff is actually six times more abundant. It caused my wife to say, well, it's kind of like that for us human beings. The dark stuff is about six times more abundant than the stuff that's good in our life. I like what the pastor said this morning. In this world, you'll have tribulation, but take heart, I've overcome the world. There will come a time when there won't be any dark stuff in your life as we enter the new creation, all of us who are followers of Jesus Christ. But it is true, the stuff that kind of makes things messy tends to dominate. I like to put it another way. In this world, you'll have thermodynamics, but take heart, I've overcome thermodynamics. If you've got thermodynamics, things decay. And decay is just a part of life, But in the new creation, there'll be no decay at all and no death at all. Well, the other thing that these three papers were focused on, in fact, one of the papers was totally devoted to this. There's been a lot of speculation. Maybe we need to adjust the Big Bang creation model because maybe general relativity is not explaining all the gravity in the universe. And so over the past 30 years, there has been hundreds of papers published saying maybe it's general relativity plus something, modified Newtonian dynamics or some other influence of gravity. And then one of the things that's been speculated is maybe gravity evolves over the history of the universe, and maybe that could explain why we see the universe expanding slightly faster today than we did when the universe was just born. And so thanks to this millions and millions of measurements of the positions and the distances of these quasars and galaxies, these astronomers were able to put a really good limit, a significantly superior limit, on whether or not gravity actually evolves with time. And basically they're saying it seems like it's zero. And and these are two factors called the mu factor and the sigma factor. And if there is no time evolution, both of them would measure to be zero. But you notice here is they do indeed measure to be zero within the error bar. So the mu factor, 0.04 plus or minus 0.22. So it certainly measures to be zero within the error bar. Then the sigma factor, they got even a better limit. It measures to be 0.009 plus or minus 0.045. So we now have a much superior measurement telling us it really does seem like there's no evolution in the force of gravity over the history of the universe. And I don't know how many have ever heard of Horndesky theory. If you've been reading the scientific literature, you'll know all about Horndesky theory. Horndesky was actually writing papers when this class was started 50 years ago. So back in 73 and 74, Horndesky said, well, everybody thinks general relativity explains all the gravitational motions in the universe, but maybe there are other factors. And so he wrote a paper saying, I can think of other ways that we could have different theories of gravity. And so Horndesky theory is basically the idea that the universe is governed, the dynamics of the universe is governed mostly by general relativity, but possibly by several other additional kinds of gravity. And so when I was an undergraduate, there were two theories of gravity that were being competing. There was general relativity and what's called the Brons-Dickey theory. And Brons and Dickey were two astrophysicists who were trying to find a way to get rid of this Big Bang creation event. They were atheists. And so they were saying, can we conceive of the universe where we don't have this general relativity? And so they're basically hypothesizing a new theory of gravity that would replace general relativity. And they were making several predictions about what would happen with the dynamics of galaxies, and in particularly the physics of the sun. And I actually heard Robert Dickey speak about this when I was at the University of British Columbia. In fact, I want to give Robert Dickey some credit. I was a sophomore undergraduate student, and I wanted to join the American Astronomical Society, because if I could join, I could get all their journals for just $10 a year. Now I'm paying $1,000 a year. So, I mean, this is a big saving, right? And but the only way you can join the American Astronomical Society, if you have a member in good standing that basically is willing to sign a statement, if you're a student, that you're a serious student who will be pursuing a doctoral degree in astrophysics. And I was only a sophomore undergraduate. And so I went to the chairman of the physics department and said, hey, I thought for sure he had to be a member because he wrote a paper that predicted the existence of neutron stars. And that led to the prediction that there would be black holes. So I said, he's got to be a member. Turns out he wasn't. But Robert Dickey came to speak to promote his theory that general relativity was wrong and the history of gravity was correct. And so they brought me into the chairman's office. I got to meet Robert Dickey. He asked me questions for about 20 minutes to see if I was really serious and qualified to pursue a doctoral degree in astrophysics. And then he signed my application. And a couple of weeks later, I got my first issue of the Astrophysical Journal. And a couple of issues after that, I saw a paper with Robert Dickey's name on it. I says, well, I got to read this. Well, it turns out it was a companion piece to the paper that was written by Arnold Penzias and Robert Wilson, saying we found the radiation left over from the cosmic creation event, which eventually won the Nobel Prize. And the interesting story behind that, you had these two astronomers finding some excess radiation in their telescope and trying to figure out what it is. And so they thought, well, maybe there's something wrong with the telescope that there was. And one of the more interesting things is they noticed there were a lot of pigeons flying around. So they thought, maybe we have some dielectric substance on the telescope surface that's responsible for this extra radiation. But they cleaned all the pigeon droppings off and got the same result. And they said, nope, that's not it at all. We don't have any idea what this excess radiation is. And then somebody said, well, why don't you call Robert Dickey? He's got a paper out predicting this excess radiation. So they phoned Robert Dickey, and Dickey's literally fell when he heard the news. Why? Because he and three graduate students had just built a radiometer that would be sensitive enough to detect this excess radiation, and he just found out he'd been scooped. Somebody beat him to it. And we're talking literally within weeks, because his graduate students had just finished completing the radiometer and were now taking observations, and they felt within a few days they would make the discovery, but then they found out they had been scooped. What I found quite interesting is Wilson and Penzias really didn't know what they discovered. Robert Dickey explained to them what they had discovered. You discovered the radiation left over from the cosmic creation event. And the Nobel Committee said, hey, we have to give the prize to Wilson and Penzias and Dickey, because Dickey was actually pursuing the discovery. He knew what it was all about, and he explained to Wilson and Penzias what they had discovered. But Dickey, being an atheist, didn't want to get credit for proving the Big Bang creation model. Moreover, he basically said, I think they deserve the credit. I don't want to take any credit away from Wilson and Penzias. So he declined to be included in the prize. But I do remember him giving a lecture saying, you know what, if the Big Bang model is right, then we got this God and we can't have that. So let's actually come up with a different theory where we don't need that. Well, since that time, they've actually come up with other ideas that maybe there's a particle that existed in the early universe called the dilaton, and maybe that would explain gravity to some degree, quintessence, chameleon, covariant, Galilean. I'm not going to go into all these. These are quite technical. But what the dark energy spectroscopic instrument team did is they said, let's actually determine how much gravity can be attributed to something other than general relativity. And basically, is not much at all. So if general relativity governs everything, then what's called the omega zero factor will be exactly zero. And what the dark energy spectroscopic instrument team determined, it's 0.0141 with an error bar of about 0.03. So basically, they're saying it really looks like Horndesky theory is incorrect. General relativity explains everything. And if general relativity explains everything, there is no way you can escape the fact that the universe has a beginning that includes a beginning of space and time itself. But what was most fascinating or interesting for the astronomers, they wanted to know what this team had discovered about the rate at which the universe expands. And so it's called the Hubble constant. And the Hubble Space Telescope was put into orbit primarily to try to measure with greater precision the rate at which the universe expands. And literally for decades, astronomers have been convinced that the rate of expansion of the universe is a constant. And so there's been almost an 80-year quest to determine what is the Hubble constant. Edwin Hubble himself believed that the expansion rate of the universe was constant. And when I was an undergraduate, there was one team of astronomers that said, our measurements show that the universe is actually expanding quite rapidly, 100 kilometers per second for every megaparsec. You say, what on earth is a megaparsec? A parsec is 3.26 light years. A mega means a million. So it's 100 kilometers per second for every 3.6 million light years of distance from the Earth. And when I was at the University of Toronto as a graduate student, a team headed up by Sidney Vandenberg was pushing that it was 100. And when I showed up at Caltech, there was a famous astrophysicist there. In fact, he attended the class here while he was alive. He's passed away since, Alan Sandage. And he was arguing for 50 kilometers per second, kilometers per second per megaparsec. And I remember one cosmologist speaking to us students at the University of Toronto saying, one group says 50, one group says 100. What's a factor of two amongst friends? It's only a factor of two. But it did disturb people into thinking, do we really have a good handle on the Big Bang creation model if we can only measure the rate of expansion of the universe to a factor of two? But I also remember Sidney Vandenberg saying, wait a minute, if you go back to about 1930, 1940, we can only measure it to a factor of 10. Now we got it down to a factor of two. So we're making progress. And I remember towards the end of my graduate education, basically the two groups were coming closer together. They were saying 60 to 80, which means it's 70 plus or minus 10. So it's no longer a factor of two difference. And the difference between the two sets of team is getting closer and closer. However, there's still what's being referred to as the Hubble tension. The Hubble constant tension is the fact that when we measure the rate of the expansion of the universe by looking at galaxies nearby to us, we see it's slightly faster than the rate of expansion we get if we look at the cosmic microwave background radiation, which is measuring how fast the universe expands during its first million years. And the difference is about, 5%. If you look at the results you get from looking at the radiation left over from the cosmic creation event, basically how fast the universe is expanding during its first million years, you get a number of 67. If you look at galaxies that are within the vicinity of our Milky Way galaxy, you get a number that's about 73. So there's a difference of 5 kilometers per second. And you say, well, if a factor of two is no big deal, why are astronomers worried about a difference of only 5 kilometers per second? The reason why they're worried, they now have measurements that are accurate to about 1%. So we got 73 plus or minus 1%. You got 67 plus or minus 1%. And so the difference is bigger than the error bar. Still not big enough that you can actually say maybe they're just a measuring error. But it's still something that has been bothering astrophysicists. Now, this team of hundreds of astronomers, they came up with a new measurement. Now keep in mind, you're looking at 73, say if you're looking at the first few billion years of the history of the universe. You get 67 if you look at the first million years. And so one of the rationales for this project is that they wanted to actually get a measurement that's in between. So let's look at galaxies that are, say, 8, 10, 11 billion light years away. That would be between the beginning of the universe and the present time of the universe. And so they did indeed get a measurement of what's called the Hubble constant that was in between. Here's their number, 68 0.4 plus or minus 0.27 kilometers per second per megaparsec. So we got the first million years is 67. You get around 10 billion, or the, say you go forward about 4 or 5 billion years, you get 68 and a half, and then in the present universe, you get 73. So it's basically demonstrating you seem to be getting different numbers as you go from the very beginning of the universe to the present day universe. And this measurement, 68.4 plus or minus 0.27, it ranks as the most accurate measurement of the expansion rate of the universe. We're no longer talking 1% precision. This is down at a 0.5% precision, actually about 0.4% precision. So it's 2.5 times more accurate than any other measurement that's been made today. And that's because it was based on millions and millions of galaxies and quasars. But as they said in their three papers, this is affirming what we saw literally back in July. In July, the same team published what they thought was, hey, we're going to give you an advanced look at what we think the first year results are going to show us. So they're basically looking at the first few months, and they said, for the first time, we think we got a strong enough indication that dark energy is not governed by a single constant. Instead, it seems like dark energy varies very slightly over the history of the universe. So we have a time-varying dark energy. These three papers are basically saying we got a stronger case for what we claimed last July. The evidence is now stronger that indeed this is the case. And this is actually looking at, because literally for the past 20 years, astronomers, as they looked at this difference between the measurement of the early universe versus the measurement of the late universe, are saying the easiest way to resolve the tension is to have dark energy vary slightly over the history of the universe. For the first time, we've got a team of astronomers saying we got measurements that seem to indicate that that's the case. They published their initial estimate back in July. Now they got a stronger case. It's the strongest evidence to date that the dark energy equation of state varies as the universe ages. Now, I've written two articles you'll see at reasons.org on how to resolve this Hubble tension. And there's basically three ways to resolve it. That if the universe's curvature slightly departs from a flat geometry, that would take care of it. Not really, because we now have measurements that is flat to four places the decimal. So it looks like having a slightly different, if the departure from a flat universe isn't going to do much. The easiest way is what these astronomers are saying. If you got dark energy varying over the history of the universe, that would explain why we got the universe expanding faster in the present universe than the past universe. Dark energy is the energy embedded in the space surface of the universe. It has nothing to do with light or heat. It's not electromagnetic. That's why they call it dark. It has no interaction with light whatsoever. It's simply the elastic effect in the space surface of the universe. And to put this in context, we need to realize that all those galaxies that you see out there, they're all confined to the surface of the universe. There's no galaxies inside the surface. There's no galaxies outside the surface. Now, before we get a picture that it's kind of like planet Earth, where all the cities are on the surface of the three-dimensional Earth, you got to bump it up by one dimension. All these galaxies are on the three-dimensional surface, not the two-dimensional surface of a four-dimensional universe. And don't try to visualize it. It can't be done. We can mathematically work it out, and we can prove it physically, this is the way it is, but don't try to get a picture in your mind of how this all operates. But the way dark energy works is that as the universe expands, the space surface gets bigger and bigger. So the analogy you've seen on TV where you got somebody blowing up a balloon, that's kind of what we're looking at. As the universe gets older and older, the balloon gets bigger and bigger and bigger. But the way dark energy operates, as the balloon gets bigger and bigger, it causes this expansion of the universe to go faster and faster. Now, if it's governed by a single constant, it'll get faster at a certain rate. The problem is our observations are showing us it's getting faster at a faster rate than what we predict if dark energy is governed by a single constant. It's getting faster at a little more rate than we thought. Not by much. So what this team is basically saying, if we have dark energy increasing in value as the universe gets older and older, that gives us just enough extra expansion to explain the differences between the expansion rate in the first 1 million years, the expansion rate 4 or 5 billion years later, and the expansion rate we see today. It really does solve the problem. But there's a couple other ways that we can take care of it. Number one, we know that our Milky Way galaxy is in an under-dense region of the universe. Good thing, because if that was not the case, none of us would be alive. If you've got a lot of galaxies close to you, that will disturb the dynamics of your galaxy and make it uninhabitable for advanced life. So, yeah, we expect to be an under-dense region. But if you're in an under-dense region, that means you've got less gravity affecting the dynamics of the universe, which means under-dense regions of the universe will show a faster separation of the galaxies moving away from one another than regions that are more dense. So we know that takes care of a tiny bit of the extra expansion rate we see in the nearby universe because we're living in an under-dense region. Another thing we notice is, in fact, there's a paper published has been through the peer review process and it's been all over the internet saying the James Webb Space Telescope basically shows us that the distances of nearby galaxies based on Cepheid variable stars by the Hubble Space Telescope, which some astronomers were saying, if that is wrong, then maybe we have another way of explaining the Hubble tension. Unfortunately, for that group of people, the James Webb Space Telescope tells them there was nothing wrong with the Hubble Space Telescope measurements. We're getting the same answer with James Webb as we get with the Hubble Space Telescope. So some kind of systematic effect on the Cepheid variable stars is not going to explain the problem. But one of the graduate students that had a desk beside me at the University of Toronto was Barry Madore. Barry Madore has been heading up a team that has been focused on measuring the expansion rate of the universe in the nearby galaxies, basically galaxies out to about 5 billion years. And a few years ago, he said, maybe there really is something that's not quite right with these Cepheid variable stars. Let's use a different kind of star as a way of calibrating the distances to supernovas that allow us to see what's the expansion rate of the universe far out. And so he came up with what's called tip of the red giant branch stars. I won't go into the technical details. These are stars that are in a particular point in their evolution. To give you kind of an example, we know that our sun is getting brighter and brighter as it continues to fuse hydrogen to helium. When it runs out of hydrogen, it's going to start fusing helium, and that's when our star goes into the red giant phase. And when it goes into the red giant phase, it will no longer be 860,000 miles in diameter. It's going to become tens of millions of miles in diameter. In fact, our sun eventually will get to be so big that its diameter will be bigger than the orbit of the Earth. So that's not going to be pleasant for life on planet Earth. Our planet will literally be incinerated by the heat of the sun. If you're concerned about that impending disaster, it won't happen for another 4 billion years. But we see lots of stars where that has happened. And the tip of the red giant branch is where they go to the extreme end of that red giant development. And there's certain stars that get at the very top of that red giant branch, and those stars actually are all the same luminosity, which means we can use them to calibrate the distances to supernova eruption events. Well, the bottom line is Barry Madore showed that we actually get a different value for the expansion rate of the universe if we use tip of the red giant branch stars to calibrate everything rather than Cepheid variable stars. And he got an answer of about 71 kilometers per second. So not 73, but 71. It's like, if that stands up, that could really take care of the Hubble tension. In fact, maybe even take care of it enough, we really don't need dark energy to be varying over time. On the other hand, this team is saying it really does look like dark energy is varying over time. And so my prediction is it's probably going to be a combination of all of the above. We're going to need better calibration of Cepheid variable stars and tip of the red giant branch stars. Here's the good news. James Webb can calibrate those out to a far greater distance than the Hubble Space Telescope. But they're not going to do it tomorrow. That's like a 5 to 10 year project. So you're going to have to be patient to get that part settled out. James Webb will also be able to determine just how underdense is our local region of the universe. So that's going to help shore things up. And then we have the Euclid Telescope, not the James Webb Space Telescope, but the European Space Agency, about 8 months ago, sent a telescope to join the James Webb a million miles away from the Earth. The Euclid Telescope is more powerful than this dark energy spectroscopic instrument on Kitt Peak. Moreover, it's not on the surface of the Earth, so it's not going to have problems with light pollution at the surface. The Earth is going to be a million miles away. It's a bigger telescope. It's going to be able to survey these galaxies to a far greater extent than what's possible with a dark energy survey team. And so it's out there. Bottom line is, within about 5 years, astronomers will not have just 4.7 million accurate measurements of the positions and the distances of galaxies and quasars. They'll have 40 million. So it's going to increase by a factor of 10. And I think the Nobel team is going to wait till all those results are in before they award a Nobel Prize. But the bottom line is, don't worry about the fact that we don't know what's going on with dark energy. And don't worry about the fact that we haven't found those dark matter particles yet. We're already getting results that tell us the Big Bang creation model is secure. The Bible really did get it right when thousands of years ago it said, we live in a universe where there's a beginning that includes the beginning of space and time itself, where none of the laws of physics vary. No variation in general relativity, no variation in thermodynamics, none of the laws of physics vary. Our measurements are now proving that, and that the universe continuously expands from that cosmic creation event. I see I don't have any time to get into Noah's flood. I've actually gone 40 minutes. I can't believe that. So I'm going to stop right there, and I'll take questions you might have about cosmology, or if you want to ask me something else that's got nothing to do with cosmology, that's the way this class works. You can ask any question you want, come to the microphone to ask your question, but we also have a lot of people who are joining us online through live streaming, and as always, we alternate between people that are online and people that are here in person. So with that, it looks like we've got an online question to kick things off.
I'll trade off between online questions and live questions as long as there's enough of both, and we'll go till for another half hour till about 1:30. So our friend Doug McComb starts out with a question. He says, are there very many similarities between the doctrines of the Aaronic priesthood of Mosaic times and the earlier priesthood of Melchizedek, known of by Abraham and mentioned in Genesis 14?
Okay, good question. There's not a lot in the Bible about Melchizedek. We do meet him in Genesis. You also see him referred to in Hebrews. What's interesting about Hebrews is it talks about the difference between the priesthood of Aaron and the priesthood of Melchizedek. And basically it's saying the priesthood of Aaron, they would offer sacrifices repeatedly for the sins of the Jewish people, but it says of Melchizedek that he has a sacrifice that's permanent and untransferable, in the sense that the sacrifices offered by the Aaronic priesthood, they were symbols for the sacrifice that would bring salvation to all people who commit their lives to the creator of the universe. And so in many respects, what Hebrews is telling us, there's some divine aspect to Melchizedek, because it says that when Abraham offered a sacrifice to him, this Melchizedek had a permanent priesthood, a permanent, untransferable priesthood, and the only priest that would fall into that category would be Jesus Christ. So there's some kind of connection or epiphany between Melchizedek and Jesus Christ, because what Hebrews tells us is the priests of Aaron, they were temporary priests. They served as a priest for a period of time, then they would transfer their priesthood to the next generation of priests, but Melchizedek had a priesthood that was permanent and untransferable. So all along is basically making the point that there will be a sacrifice that will deliver us. Hebrews also goes on to make the point that the sacrifices offered by the priests of Aaron had no effect on delivering us from sin. Basically says the blood of bulls and goats has no effect on delivering us from sin. It's a symbol of the sacrifice that would deliver us. And so Melchizedek is basically representing that. Now, there's been a lot of speculation. Is Melchizedek Jesus Christ, or is it some kind of figurative representation to what Jesus would do? Hey, we're working on three entire sentences in the Bible. That's it. So don't try to draw too much of a doctrinal point from what it says in just those three texts. But what we can be assured of is that the sacrifices offered by the Aaronic priesthood, the sacrifices offered in generations before Moses, where the patriarchs would offer the sacrifices for their families, their extended family, all of those were symbolic of the one and only sacrifice that truly can deliver us from sin and evil. Okay, next question.
So this is more of what's your opinion? On the news, there's been these observations of these lights in the sky, and some say they're drones, some say they're aircraft, and government says, well, we don't know what they are, and I can't believe that nobody knows what they are. I just want to know, what's your opinion?
Well, I was actually called by Fox News on Friday saying, hey, can you be willing to do a little piece explaining what all these things are? It's in New Jersey, where people have been seeing, quote, lights in the sky, and there's a lot of speculation. Are these UFOs? Is it military activity, or is it just people playing around with their drones? And if it's drones, are these big drones that the Russians have for spying on us? Are they Chinese drones? Are they? So people were thinking, are we facing some threat from Iran, China, or Russia? With these drones, or is it just private citizens with their drones that are causing problems? But it was sufficient that one New Jersey airport, an international airport, was shut down, saying, hey, if these things are flying around, this is not safe for aircraft, so they literally shut down the airport that was in the vicinity. So what happened yesterday, that was on Friday, where there was all this speculation, and basically I just shared with the Fox News people, number one, we know these are not craft from another planetary system because that would violate the laws of physics. I think I've shared with this class before, the biggest spaceship you can send across interstellar space is about 10 centimeters in diameter. And hey, these things were bigger than that, so to say that's not it. And also I made the point, there's over 1 million sophisticated drones owned by private American citizens. So that many drones running around, it could easily be just some private citizen. And they said, well, are we talking small drones? Some of these privately owned drones are actually quite big enough even to transport big heavy packages from one location to the other. You're probably aware that one of the ideas that Amazon has is actually laying off a bunch of their employees and having drones drop your packages off on your doorstep. They're not quite there yet, but they're working on it. So it just shows you how much our whole civilization has been changed by drones. What was released early this morning is, yeah, we really think these are private citizen drones. They ruled out that they were these heavy Russian drones. The Russians have drones about the size of an automobile that they use for taking, getting spy information. They said, we know it's not that. We know it's not China or Iran. It really looks like it's private U.S. citizens using their drones in a way that's illegal. If you've got a drone, U.S. law requires that your drone not go higher than 400 feet above the ground. If you go more than 400 feet above the ground, you're actually breaking the law. And there's also restrictions on what kinds of drones you can have flying around. The problem is, a lot of these people have drones that are kind of like my dad. When he got to the point where his knees were totally shot and he was waiting for a knee replacement and couldn't get it, they got him one of these wheelchairs that he could run around in and go where he wants to go. But being a machinist, he said, hey, this thing only goes 4 miles an hour. I'm going to soup it up. So he souped it up to where it could go 8 miles per hour. And it caused some consternation in his neighborhood. But the whole point is there are people who have drones that say, you know what, I'm going to, you know, re-engineer the drone that I just purchased. And so we have a lot of re-engineered drones. I don't know how many of the million owned drones are in that category, but quite a few of them are. And people are actually making the drones bigger, putting bigger battery systems in them. So what's happening is Congress, as of this morning, is saying we're going to have to actually get more proactive in trying to control private citizen drones, which means we're going to start prosecuting people who take their drones higher than 400 feet. And we're going to start prosecuting people who have these really big drones that, and if they get close to airports. And so they're actually thinking, maybe we'll actually have the Air Force help us shoot down these drones that are violating the law. So we'll see. And by the way, our government has been aware that a lot of private citizens are violating the law, the drone laws. It's just that they realize shooting them down is expensive. That means you got to, you know, get an aircraft up there. It's got to be weaponized to shoot down the drone. They said, that's just too much money. We're going to ignore the problem. Probably what's going to happen, Congress is going to tell the U.S. public, look, unless you police yourselves, we're going to step in and start shooting down your expensive drones. If you don't want that to happen, please clean up your act, because we don't want to spend a lot of taxpayer money shooting down your drones. Please behave yourselves. But we all know how that works when you got little children, right? It doesn't always work. So we'll see what happens. Next question.
James Vierdig has a question. He says, since Noah started the second civilization after he landed from the ark, shouldn't archaeological history show an emergence of civilization at or around the area that he landed?
Well, actually, that is the case. So the earliest evidence we have for the Neolithic Revolution is in the mountains at the north end of the Mesopotamian plain. And given that the Ark came to rest in the region called the Mountains of Ararat, guess where that is? That's at the north edge of the Mesopotamian plain. That's the first place where we see humans building villages and towns and developing trade systems. It's the first place where we see large-scale domestication of wheat and large-scale domestication of goats. So the evidence is actually there. Although I want to, that evidence goes back about 12 to 13,000 years. We have even earlier evidence, and this evidence is scattered around the world, for humans actually doing metallurgy and engaging in sophisticated bakery practices. So that's not limited to just that one region. But that is a place where you begin to see this sudden development of civilization. But there was isolated small-scale civilizations going back previously, how much previously. Carbon-14 dating tells us it goes back at least 33,000 years.
Hi, Dr. Ross. I have a really good friend of mine who's got, well, let's say, a very hard time believing that the Word of God is from God. And one of the reasons is because there's two accounts of the Noah's flood in Genesis. Can you help reconcile that?
He may be talking about two accounts of creation. There's a single account of Noah's flood, Genesis 6 through 9. What I usually hear from skeptics is, well, you got an account of the creation of humanity in Genesis 1, and you got what looks like a very different account in Genesis chapter 2. And in Genesis 2, you get a very brief summary of God's creation. It's in verses 5 and 6. So it's usually what you hear is, why do you have two side-by-side accounts of creation, and why do they read so differently? I respond to that in some detail in the book Navigating Genesis. In fact, I think we have a book table over there. If you want to get a copy of the book, talk to this gentleman right here, and he'll help you get that. And what I review in that book is that the reason why you have two side-by-side accounts of creation, Genesis 1 is focused on the physical creation and gives you a very quick summary of the spiritual creation. Genesis 2 is the opposite. The focus is on the spiritual creation and just a very brief statement about the physical creation. And here's another distinction. The physical events are chronologically ordered in Genesis 1. In Genesis 2, it's just a list with no chronology, and it's an abbreviated list. And likewise, what you see in Genesis 2 as a chronological ordering of the spiritual message. And the core of the spiritual message is God assigning authority and responsibility to humanity. It's basically saying, I'm putting you in charge of the planet to manage it for your benefit and the benefit of all life. And then God begins to give instructions. I mean, all you see in Genesis 1 is a single sentence. You're in charge. In Genesis 2, God gets explicit about, and what he does is he introduces Adam first to the physical creation, then to the soulless creation, and last of all, the spiritual creation, saying, you're responsible to manage the resources of the planet, not just physically, but also soulishly and spiritually. And by soulishly, I mean emotionally, intellectually, and no willfully. And so that's the reason for the two side by side. And when people say they contradict one another, what they're ignoring is that the physical events are in a chronological order in Genesis 1. They're not in a chronological order in Genesis 2. What you see, especially when you look at the original Hebrew, in Genesis 1, you got multiple clues in the text that this is an ordered sequence of events. The days are numbered. You got the repeated phrase, it was good, and also the preceded phrase, and it was so. That phrase, it was so, is basically saying, this happened after this. So you got multiple clues in the original Hebrew text telling you that this is a chronology of events. When you go to the physical events in Genesis 2, 5, and 6, all those clues are missing. None of them are there. And it's an abbreviated. It's only mentioning four things. So it's not giving you a complete list. And so looking in the English translation and saying, hey, we got a problem here. Men are mentioned before the dirt of the earth. Well, the text isn't saying that, you know, this is an ordered text. It's just saying God did these four things. It's not putting them in any kind of chronological order. Likewise, you get the same problem. What you have in Genesis 2 is an ordering of the spiritual events. In Genesis 1, it's a simple sentence. So there is no contradiction between the two. And hey, given that God wanted to communicate his creation message, not only physically, but spiritually, you do need two texts. And they're right next to one another.
Hugh, we have a question for Mark Wilburn that's going to require you to spend half your time explaining the terms. So, his question, the Lin-Shu density wave model was supposed to explain galactic rotational continuity. It's been a while since the detection of gravity waves by LIGO, L-I-G-O. Has the Lin-Shu density wave model been validated or abandoned? So explain Lin-Shu density wave model, galactic rotation continuity, and LIGO.
All right. A little bit of a technical issue there. And the Lin-Shu model to explain the spiral structure of galaxies, it literally goes back 60 years. So, the question is, what is the technical support for that? It's very well supported. And so, just to give you an idea, we have our Milky Way spiral galaxy, which is a representative spiral galaxy. And what we notice is that the spiral arm structure seems to rotate rigidly. And what we get from Newton's laws of motion is that the stars in our galaxy will revolve around the center of the galaxy faster and faster as you go towards the center. I mean, it's the same thing you see in our solar system. And it was Newton who said, this is the way all bodies in the universe behave. Newton's laws of motion. If you've got a body orbiting another body, the closer the orbit, the faster the orbit. So with Mercury, it goes around the sun in about 3 months. For Earth, it's 1 year. For Jupiter, it's about 10 years. So the farther away the planet, the longer it takes to go around. This is also true of the stars in our Milky Way galaxy. The farther away they are, the longer they take to go around the center of the galaxy. And so our star, the sun, for example, it takes 250 million years to make one circuit around the center of our galaxy. But if you go out into the halo, we're looking at about 8 billion years for them to make one trip around the center of our galaxy. And so Shu and his team basically said, we have to explain why it is that the spiral arms don't seem to obey that law. They appear to rigidly rotate, whereas the stars obey Newton's laws. And he came up with what was called the density wave theory, which basically says that our Milky Way galaxy is a fairly large galaxy. It comes in at about 1 trillion times the mass of our star, the sun. Galaxies that massive will attract small dwarf galaxies towards it. These small dwarf galaxies are very gas rich, much more rich in gas than, say, a big galaxy. And so our Milky Way galaxy has basically been consuming these gas-rich tiny galaxies, and they get drawn into the core of the Milky Way, and that gas gets funneled out by a gravity wave throughout our galaxy. So it carries gas out, and that gas forms new stars. So when you look at the spiral arms in our galaxy, notice the stars are bright and blue. That means they're newly formed stars. So basically, Shu is saying the stars that make up the spiral arms, they change throughout the history of the Milky Way galaxy. And so the spiral arm structure is rigid, but the galaxy stars that compose them are not. And so the galaxies are in the spiral, the stars are in the spiral arms, will be moving away from the spiral arms. He developed this theory some 60 years ago. For the past 60 years, astronomers have been studying spiral galaxies to test, is this theory really true? And now where this falls into biblical creation, young Earth creationists have been basically saying Shu was wrong. This gravity wave theory is completely incorrect. It doesn't really explain anything, which is why in the fourth edition of The Creator and the Cosmos, I have a chapter there basically giving you the latest evidence showing, hey, this is very well established. Now, part of the question was, does LIGO help add proof that this density wave theory explains why the spiral structure appears rigid, even though the stars are obeying Newton's laws? And LIGO has got nothing to do with it. LIGO is measuring gravity waves, but gravity waves in a completely different scale. Basically, what LIGO is doing is actually trying to detect the gravity waves. What Shu is just saying is that If you look at the dynamics of all these stars that are forming from gas being infused into our Milky Way galaxy, you do see what looks like a wave pattern that explains the spiral structure. He wasn't claiming that these were actual gravity waves that are being governed by graviton particles. The LIGO instrument is actually doing that. They're actually detecting these gravity waves, and they're detecting them as a result of neutron stars smashing into one another to make a black hole, or two black holes smashing into one another to make a black hole. That's the only way you can detect the gravity waves, because gravity waves are 10,000 trillion, trillion, trillion times weaker than electromagnetic waves, which means it's going to be really difficult to detect them. The only way you can detect them is in the vicinity of extremely strong gravitational forces, such as what happens when two neutron stars merge together to become a neutron star. So LIGO is irrelevant to the gravity, density wave issue. And that's really what astronomers call them. They call it the density wave theory. They don't call it the gravity wave theory, even though gravity actually plays a big role in explaining this density wave we see in spiral galaxies. But hey, if you want to read about all the details, it's in the book, The Crater in the Cosmos, 4th edition. And yes, it is very stable. It's well established. No one in the scientific literature today is disputing it. They were 50 years ago, but not in the last few years. Okay.
My question comes right out from what you were just talking about. One of the things that you didn't mention was talking about the structure of the Milky Way galaxy and our stable arms. The Milky Way galaxy is the only galaxy we've found so far, I believe, that we can find life in. So my question is how big is the catalog of galaxies that astronomers have? For stars, I know it's about 20 million, if you could verify that also. So have we found, we haven't found a Milky Way twin yet.
Okay. We do know there's about 2 trillion galaxies in the observable universe. How many of those galaxies are able to measure with any precision the structure of the galaxy? It's in the millions. So no, we're nowhere near the 2 trillion mark, because most of those 2 trillion galaxies are so far away and the galaxies are so small, we can detect them, we can measure, we got some idea what they're like, their masses, their sizes, but we don't know the details, say, on their spiral structure. We do have millions that have been cataloged. And astronomers have several independent catalogs of galaxies where they classify what type of galaxy, the mass of the galaxy, and with the spiral galaxies, information of the spiral structure. But your point is true. One thing I put in the book, Design to the Core, I show you 12 spiral galaxies that come the closest to matching the spiral structure you see of our Milky Way galaxy. Those are the 12 that come the closest, and none of them come anywhere near the symmetry of the spiral arms of a Milky Way galaxy, or the lack of warping in the spiral arm structure, or in what's called the pitch angle, the angle between one spiral arm and the next spiral arm, the distance between the spiral arms. And what you notice in those other 12 spiral galaxies, you've got a lot of stuff between the spiral arms. We do in our Milky Way galaxy as well, but nowhere near as much, quote, junk between the spiral galaxies. We don't call it junk. We call it feathers and spurs. But one of the properties of our Milky Way galaxy is how few feathers and spurs it indeed has. So just like the Sun doesn't have a twin, our Milky Way galaxy, likewise, doesn't have a twin, an adequate twin, where advanced life would be possible. On a planet orbiting the star or a star within that galaxy.
And then the other part of that question was for the solar, looking for solar twin, that the catalog of stars is about 20 million. Is that correct, or is that grown?
Well, we do have a very large catalog of stars. Again, it's in the millions, but not all the stars in that catalog do we have accurate measurements of their characteristics. One of the most difficult characteristics to measure is the age of the star. And so often you'll see a catalog where they say, We think it's 4 billion years old, but the error bar is plus or minus a billion years. So not all these factors. We can measure the brightness quite accurately. The mass can be a challenge too, because to measure the mass of a star, you need another star orbiting it, or you need a planet that's been detected orbiting it. So often, we don't know the mass. So, but yeah, we've yet to find a star that comes close to matching our star, the Sun. Again, what you'll see in Design to the Core, I show you the luminosity stability of our star compared to the luminosity stability of the second best star we've been able to find. That second best star has a luminosity instability 5 times greater than our star, the Sun. And a luminosity instability that high would make it impossible for us to have global high-technology civilization. So I hope at Thanksgiving time you thank God for the Sun.
Thank you, Hugh. Doug McComb has another really good question. He says, how would you define space? He says, is it correct to say that space contains matter, energy, and dark matter? But if so, then what distinguishes space from those things?
Yeah. Space is a dimension, and our universe has 4 dimensions, length, width, height, and time. There are also 6 very tiny space dimensions that accompany the 3 big expanding ones. Again, in Big Bang cosmology, the universe starts off with 9 dimensions of space. All 9 expand from the cosmic creation event, but when the universe is 10 to the minus 43 seconds old, 6 of the 9 stop expanding, which means they're extremely tiny at this point in time. And that space can contain matter and energy, doesn't have to. In fact, when the universe was created, the universe had no energy, no photons, and no particles, no matter. It took the release of space curvature to create the photons and later the mass of particles. So the universe begins with space-time curvature, but as the universe expands, the curvature gets released. The release of curvature first produces photons. That happens when the universe is about a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second old. And then when it's about 100 billionth of a second old, you get have mass of particles. Now, unlike E equals mc squared, which says you can convert energy into matter and matter into energy, where it's reversible, you cannot take stretched out space curvature, collapse it back, and get matter and energy disappearing. It's irreversible. You can release space curvature to get matter and energy, but you can't take matter and energy and create space curvature. So it's a one-way situation. Hopefully that answers this question.
Hugh, we're out of time, but I want to say first thank you to all the people who every week come online and chit-chat amongst themselves in the live chat. Us and live in the group don't see it, but they're out there listening, and there's always about twice as many questions online as we can answer. So greetings to everybody that's online. Thank you all for being there, and keep asking your questions. They're terrific questions. Hugh, would you please close us in prayer?
Sure. Father in heaven, we do thank you for these questions, and Lord, I pray that during this Christmas season, as we move into the new year, that you would give us opportunities to answer questions that people have about you, about creation, and about our purpose and role in your creation. We thank you that you sent the Creator to visit us 2,000 years ago and sacrifice his life so that we can actually have a pathway to be permanently delivered from our sin and evil. Help us to be grateful during this time for what you've done on our behalf, and help us to share that gratefulness with people around us and to show them how they too can receive more of your love, life, and truth. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.